Yep, that looks good. Oh,
Perfect.
he's recording. Thank you, Anya.
Thank you. All right. So several articles of interest this time around. And let me see if I can see everyone here as well. Somehow minimize that. All right, perfect. So the first one I have for discussion this morning is out of the group at Boston, as well as contributors at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And what they looked at was carcinomas in individuals who have systemic sclerosis or other collagen vascular associated disease, interstitial lung disease, who also have carcinoma, trying to understand if the landscape genomically of those tumors is different from those in people who do not have those underlying diseases. And it's well known that, actually, it wasn't all that well known to me, but they do go into that individuals with systemic sclerosis and other collagen vascular diseases have an increased risk of lung cancer. And here they point out the increased risk for those varieties of condition underlying conditions, as opposed to just the general population. And what they wanted to understand are these tumors similar from a genetic underpinning or not? So the study population looked at a large database, as one might imagine, of patients with non-small cell lung carcinoma who tumors underwent genomic sequencing. And out of those, they were able to extract 27 patients who had systemic sclerosis. And in addition to that, there were 10 other individuals who had some other form of connective tissue disease-associated interstitial lung disease, who developed non-small cell lung cancer and their tumors underwent genomic testing. And what they, this is the clinical pathologic features of the patients who had non-small cell lung cancer and systemic sclerosis. You can see the breakdown of gender, age, ethnicity. And what they specifically looked at, which of course makes sense, is they broke down patients into those that were never or light smokers, comparing those to moderate or heavy smokers. And what they found was most of the patients who had systemic sclerosis who were moderate to heavy smokers actually infrequently had interstitial lung disease, whereas those who were never to light smokers all had interstitial lung disease, most of which were an NSIP pattern. And I think they show, yes, they show the pattern of fibrotic NSIP in one of these patients here. And then with respect to what they found in terms of the molecular underpinnings of these lung cancers was that compared to patients who did not have systemic sclerosis, those that did had a significant lack of driver alterations that were typical of never smokers. So they did not have EGFR, ERBB2 mutations, HER2, and oncogenic fusions. And in fact, let me see if they have a diagram that can make good sense of this here. Yes, they do here in this figure three, in that none of the patients with systemic sclerosis who were never light smokers had these type of genetic alterations, whereas individuals who did not have systemic sclerosis, about 474 out of 1,255 did. And this was statistically significant with a p-value shown here. And instead, what these patients had, and I'm going to try to see if we can see it in this figure, is that they had TP53 alterations and mutation in APOBEC. And for people following along at home, that's apolipoprotein B, mRNA editing enzyme, catalytic polypeptide-like attributable variants. And these were disproportionately more frequent in the individuals who were never or light smokers who had systemic sclerosis compared to not those that did not have systemic sclerosis. I think this is better illustrated in figure four here. And this was a statistically significant finding. I don't think they have a figure of other patients with connective tissue interstitial lung disease, but they had genomic findings that were similar to those with systemic sclerosis. Let's see. So in sum, what they found was that the genomics of patients with systemic sclerosis and other inflammatory interstitial lung diseases who developed non-small cell lung carcinoma, particularly those patients that were never or light smokers, had distinct genomic alterations as compared to individuals who were never light smokers but did not have one of these underlying connective tissue lung disease. In particular, frequent P53 alterations, paucity of targetable alterations, unfortunately, and this enrichment in this APOBEC signature. And so what's postulated from that is that chronic autoimmune inflammation might stimulate this enzymatic pathway that leads to tumorigenesis. So I thought that this was an interesting patient population that hadn't really been well studied before in terms of trying to understand from a molecular standpoint what the underlying driving factors are of their lung cancers. And certainly it is important in terms of thinking about therapies for these types of patients, because unfortunately the paucity of driver mutations means that we can't just pull some of these less cytotoxic therapies off the shelf for these individuals and may need to think about some drugs that are more advantageous to targeting the types of alterations that they have. Any questions about this particular study?
Thanks, Kelly. Can you hear me? This is Henry.
Yeah. Hey, Henry. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Did, you may have mentioned it, but any preponderance, were they all adenocarcinomas, squam, the spectrum?
Yeah. It was a spectrum. Let me just, yes, here in table one, it looks like, as one might expect, the vast majority were adenocarcinomas, 85% versus 11% squamous cell carcinomas. And it looks like only one of their cases, they didn't specify what the tumor was. So I think that's pretty much what one would expect, although I don't know if they went into detail with their non-connective tissue disease patients in terms of the breakdown of what those patients had. But to me, that seems like a pretty, nowadays in Western populations, seems like a pretty reasonable breakdown of what you might expect, but they may have gone into greater detail about comparing to the non-connective tissue disease individuals, but I just don't see that obviously right here.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Any other questions or comments about this? Is anyone else familiar? I must admit, is anyone else familiar? I have talked about in other settings this APOBEC genetic alteration, perhaps those who do more molecular pathology? All right, I'm glad I'm not the only one that this is somewhat new to me in terms of that. All right, well, with that, let's go to the next article for discussion. And this is from includes authors of our very own journal club here, contributing from Mayo Scottsdale, Brandon, and Henry. Thanks for your contributions to this case series. And it's primary pulmonary ameloblastoma. And this is a collaborative effort. These cases were collected at three different institutions, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see, from Sloan Kettering. And it looks like there was one contributor from a VA case, and then consulted upon at Mayo Scottsdale as well. And if I'm forgetting anyone, please point that out to me. But there were three cases in total that the argument is made for these being looking like ameloblastoma in the head and neck region, but in three patients who had no disease outside the lung. So in sum, these three tumors were peripheral lung masses that are shown in this radiograph here. And they were about 5.5 to 7.5 centimeters. They were all in adults, 40 to 68 years of age. And all of these individuals underwent lobectomy for resection. And they very carefully, in retrospect, looked at imaging clinical findings, exam findings in the jaws of these individuals after looking at these tumors to ensure that there were no NAFIC primary tumor in these individuals. And what was found histologically was an appearance that was very reminiscent of ameloblastoma in the jaw. And Henry can certainly wax more poetic on the histologic features that we see here, but what we have is this kind of stellate, loose, slightly myxoid, reticular collection of cells, and they were loosely arranged. And at the periphery of these areas, we have this reverse polarity of cells. In addition to that, they had this kind of streaming or swirling architecture and were somewhat spindled. They noted that these areas were rich in mast cells as well. And then there were these duct-like spaces that contained this dense basophilic material within them. Immunohistochemically, you can see that these cells in these stellate areas and the cells at the periphery had P40 positivity. But interesting, what caused some diagnostic difficulty is that in some of these areas with these duct-like structures, there was TTF1 positivity that led to concerns if this was a biphasic type of neoplasm. Additional immunohistochemistry was done for BRAF V600E, and what was found was that all three of the tumors had immunostaining for this, and in two of them, BRAF V600E mutations were also confirmed. Importantly, what was pointed out was that these prominent duct-like structures that has some TTF1 positivity really caused some diagnostic challenges in terms of being concerning for a biphasic neoplasm, at least initially. And what was shown, interestingly, was that the BRAF was not staining these TTF1 positive cells. So at the end of the day, they were interpreted as entrapped floridly reactive entrapped pneumocytes. Here's some additional photomicrographs from another case as well, again, highlighting this mixed picture of P40 staining and then these entrapped TTF1 positive pneumocytes that are BRAF negative, which is an important clue to the differential diagnosis here. As far as follow-up of these cases, there in the three cases, there have been 2 to 36 months of follow-up and no recurrences have been noted. A nice discussion of the differential diagnosis of these neoplasms that were thought about, and they include some sort of peculiar looking squamous cell carcinoma, of course, myoepithelial tumors and unusual salivary type tumors were considered. And then in addition, particularly in these cases that have these really prominent reactive pneumocytes, the diagnosis of a bronchiolar adenoma was considered. And what was noted, though, is that these expansile areas of stellate reticulum that were P40 positive wouldn't really be expected in a bronchiolar adenoma. And in addition, the BRAF staining was seen only in these P40 positive areas and not in these TTF1 positive areas that were interpreted as entrapped pneumocytes, which is unlike a bronchiolar adenoma, in which the entire population would be expected to be V600E positive. So interesting lesion, obviously rare and important to keep on the radar screen when one is struggling with something that appears to be biphasic. And BRAF V600E can potentially be helpful in these types of cases in terms of looking for the lack of staining in these entrapped pneumocytes. So I appreciate Henry and others sharing this with us so we can be alert to it and perhaps avert a misdiagnosis on a case in the future. Comments, questions about this entity and this report?
Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, thank you, Henry. Yeah, do you have any other pearls for us in terms of how it came to be that you eventually ended up with this diagnosis? It seems like these were a struggle.
It was. We've had a number, including some cases from Rochester, because I reached out to a couple of those folks as well of metastases. So I think the other thing, just to say out loud, like any salivary gland tumor, is to make sure it's not a met. But, you know, we had, during the course of, you know, sort of working these cases up, made sure that the patients had Panorex, like shown in the one image you showed, to make sure there were no primaries in the jaws. And then they're just weird. They were just very odd. And I think it was Max who said, do you think this is all just entrapped pneumocytic epithelium? And, you know, that raised the possibility that this was, you know, one of these tumors where, like some hamartomas and other tumors, where you get this entrapped epithelium. That's probably even not, you know, part of the process. So they're odd. I sent it then to Natasha as a weirdoma. We've now been, you know, sending weirdomas back and forth. And she said, you know, I think we have a case. And then I think Justin Bishop was the other person who said, when she reached out to him, yeah, I think I have a case. So that's how we ended up with three.
Got it.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's more. More out there, but yeah, wild. That is wild stuff.
They were very helpful in doing some more of the molecular testing and so on at Memorial on the cases. Took a while to get it done, but as a research thing, but eventually we got them done, which was a nice confirmation of the BRAF. You know, you're always a little worried about your BRAF IHC working.
And yeah, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, ours has been really finicky, I feel like. And it's nice to have that molecular confirmation for sure.
I think, the point about bronchiolar adenomas is also a good one. We recently had a case of a bronchiolar adenoma with extensive squamous metaplasia, and there are a couple of reports of that happening as well. So, these are pretty big. Bigger than the typical bronchiolar adenoma for sure, but when you have a small biopsy, it's certainly going to be
for sure.
So looking at the BRAF in the epithelial versus this spindly looking cells, the squamoid looking cells is a good point as well.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. I haven't seen a case like that with the extensive squamous metaplasia. Imagine that would be super challenging.
Yeah, we struggled with that one too for a little while.
Wow. Great. Any other comments about this? All right. Nice photos. They're really illustrative. Okay. Well, switching gears entirely here. The next article for discussion is out of a group in China. And prior to this, they had been working on evaluating visceral pleural invasion in lung cancer without the use of elastin stains. So this article, I believe, is really predicated on another article. And I'm trying to remember if that prior article was ever discussed in this setting, but it springboarded off of using the inherent autofluorescence of eosin as a springboard to looking at elastin stain, looking at visceral pleural invasion penetration through the elastica without making a separate elastin stain to do that. And building upon that, what was done by these investigators was they used a deep learning-based model to create what they call a virtual elastin stain to assess visceral pleural invasion. And I must admit, this was one of the cases in which Matt's AI summary of this article actually helped me understand better exactly what this group was doing. So what they did was a conditional generative adversarial network was developed. I must admit, I don't know what that is, to translate a standard H&E image into a virtual representation of elastin. And the intrinsic elastin fluorescence on H&E stain sections was used to create a co-registered ground truth for training. And elastin staining using or visceral pleural invasion using just an H&E alone was compared to virtual elastin staining. And some traditional elastin staining with Victoria Blue was also evaluated in a subset of cases and evaluated by three pathologists to make sure that this training was going well. So this is an example of this autofluorescence of elastin. And here we can just see the visceral pleura. And then this is just the autofluorescence of elastin. And what you can appreciate is that it really does highlight the elastic layers here more brightly than the fibroconnective tissue. And let's see, what else do they have going on? They looked at things through a variety of fluorescence wavelengths, a variety of tissue thickness sections to determine which seemed to be the best kind of contrast. And then what they did was they did stain some of these cases with traditional elastin stains. And what can be found is in this A through D panel, there was no visceral pleural elastic invasion by non-small cell lung cancer. And here we have in this G panel, this autofluorescence of the elastica, and we don't see any tumor beyond that. And then in B through EH is an example where there is penetration of tumor through the elastic layer that can be seen on the elastin stain. And then I wish they had put some arrows in here, but I think we're able to see it as well on this virtual H&E of elastic staining. And then what they highlight is that there is a different case in the C, F, and I where there's tumor in the visceral pleura that actually doesn't show up on the deeper section that was cut for elastin staining, but does show up nicely on the original H&E that's subjected to this autofluorescence and virtual elastin stain, if you will, of this case. I mentioned that they used a different number of thicknesses of the H&E stain section to see which elastin, which virtual version of that through autofluorescence had the most contrast and was easiest to interpret. And I would point out that they felt, at least my understanding of what they felt, was that the 3 micron section was best for that, which obviously differs from what many of us use as our traditional thickness of a normal regular H&E stain section. And what else did they do here? They did highlight that by having to prepare a separate elastic stain, sometimes the area of interest is not on the elastic stain, but by using the original H&E and subjecting it to this autofluorescence, there's fidelity with the cells that you're looking at. You're not cutting through them. But they did highlight that in some cases, there was difficulty going in the other direction, in which using this virtual so-called elastin stain, what was felt to be visceral pleural invasion on H&E, was not felt to be visceral pleural invasion on H&E. Actually, on the virtual stain, there's an absence of what looks to be elastin or a break in the elastic layer in an area of tumor that the pathologists involved in this study classified as type PLA1 visceral pleural invasion. But when they didn't do the virtual computational elastin stain and just subjected this original H&E to fluorescent microscopy, that area did show up of elastic tissue as fluorescent. So there were some cases in which the virtual computation model didn't get things right in terms of not always highlighting the elastic stain. And it's certainly beyond my understanding for the explanation of why that would be so, but they just highlighted that. I think in some, this is an interesting technique that I certainly don't understand. The argument is made that this, by using an H&E stained section. One is always looking at the same area of concern and not having to have the additional time, resources, and cost of preparing a separate elastic stained section to look at, and with the potential of cutting through the area of concern and perhaps under recognizing an area of visceral pleural elastic invasion. I think the main concern with this is that the most interpretable sections were 3 micron sections, which obviously would be a change of workflow to many people's normal thickness of H&E stained sections. And so it's not exactly a, it's not as if you don't have to do anything different to use this technique. If it were a regular H&E section that you wouldn't have to do anything to, that would be something, but I think until then, I'm not sure that this is something that would be exceptionally well adopted to look at. And I think there's still concern for some of those cases in which the elastic kind of disappears in these virtual sections. So I don't know if anyone had a chance to read this article and understand it a little bit better than myself.
Hi, but Kelly.
It's something to think about. Questions, comments? Yeah, Margaret, was that you?
Oh, hi, Kelly. Yes, it's Margaret here. I put my camera on, but you've got my early morning 7:15 hair. I don't think you'd appreciate it. thank you. That's a fascinating article. It's just amazing what people are coming up with AI related things. I was just wondering if one had, you know, rarely these tumors are difficult to identify. Sometimes they're very small cells and you're not sure if they're macrophages or something at the edge. I wonder if you had an immunostain that you're done to identify the tumor, and now you're trying to figure out, is it through the elastic? Could you then just do an elastin on top of that immunostain and then use immunofluorescence?
Yeah,
that would
right.
Allow you to see it.
Right. Good point and good question. And they did not talk about that at all. And I wonder if that would not work, because the way they're talking about this is it's only the eosin that has this autofluorescence. And
you would do fluorescence and then just look at the eosin stain section that's been stained with the with the immunostain. So you do the immunostain first, put it that way, and then do an eosin on top of it.
I gotcha. Yeah, they didn't talk about that at all. I think my main issue is the thickness of the sections. I think a priori, it would be hard to know which section potentially to cut at 3 microns versus 5 microns, and would really, I think, change the workflow and histology.
I'm wondering if the autofluorescence will probably just work on our regular 4 microns.
They said so it would, but what they have this
they looked at different staining sections, and here in this one, you can see that this 3 micron, the contrast really stood out much more dramatically than in the thicker stained sections. And they just found it really difficult to interpret, apparently, other types of stained sections.
Right.
And felt that 3 microns was the best. I mean, I'm sure one could still get away with it with the 4 micron or 5 micron sections. They just felt that their error rate was not good. I guess my major other criticism of this paper was they didn't really compare this to, they did a subset of cases of elastin staining, But they didn't do a head-to-head comparison of the virtual elastic stain just on the H&E to a traditional elastin stain section. Rather, they compared it to looking to making an assessment of visceral pleural invasion on H&E, which is not really what I think most of us do if we're looking at an area of concern. So I wish that they had done that, because I don't know that that really simulates real world practice. Any other questions or comments about this one? All right. Well, lastly for us, if we had any other time, I'd highlight some more things. But what we have here, and it was kind of one of those break out the popcorn moments, because it was both a response to a classification that was put out last year of an updated classification of interstitial lung disease terminology, and then by authors that were not on the original paper, including a professor emeritus of this journal club, and then a additional response from other authors who were on the original classification paper from last year, and then a rebuttal to that by the authors, and then a rebuttal to those authors. So if you're bored later and have some time and want to get into the weeds of words mattering, this is a good read between the lines type of paper. And I wish Jeff was here to elaborate on this further. But the long and short of it is that, and I'm not sure that we discussed it in this journal club here previously, but in 2025, there was an updated classification of interstitial pneumonias that came out that was in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. And there were some new entities like DIP moving to alveolar macrophage pneumonia and some other entities that were discussed. But one of the main ones that was quite contentious for at least some people was that there was an abandonment of the term hypersensitivity pneumonitis in favor of bronchial low-centric interstitial pneumonia, BIP, and only after interdisciplinary conference and the identification of a causative antigen could the nomenclature of hypersensitivity pneumonitis be applied under that circumstance. And suffice it to say that some individuals did not take kindly to that dramatic shift in terminology and felt very strongly that hypersensitivity pneumonitis should be retained as a term, especially when you have histologic features that would be in line with that, even if you didn't have an inciting antigen. And the authors of the original criteria that made this change make an argument that we should pull back from HP and talk about idiopathic bronchiolocentric interstitial pneumonia, especially in cases where a causative exposure hasn't been identified. And the argument they make that's somewhat buried, actually, not in the rebuttal, but this pro paper, is that if you go on to look at individuals who are labeled as having BIP and look at them in the subsequent couple of years of follow-up, that a significant number of them actually turn out to have collagen vascular disease associated interstitial lung disease. So they argue that labeling a patient with HP up front does a disservice to this patient because they may not really be carefully evaluated for collagen vascular disease thereafter. But Dr. Myers and others
argue in the different direction is that when we label individuals with HP, even if an identifiable cause isn't known, there's an impetus to really dig down into those patients' environmental histories to try to get to the circumstance of what is the inciting antigen and can we remove the patient from that environment. So it's certainly a interesting, carefully couched war of words that some people are quite passionate about here. And I was wondering if anybody either read the original classification and it gave them pause in terms of scaling back the use of HP and using BIP instead, and what their thoughts are about it, whether you've adopted that or are sticking with HP. Any comments?
Yeah, I can pipe in from the Michigan group. I think, you know, as I guess children of Jeff's in some way, I think we're sticking with the HP. I feel like I kind of understand both perspectives, but I feel like I have heard stories from Jeff where there have been a number of cases where people don't have an inciting antigen, and then upon further investigation, there is something. So I do think like there is, and it is like a word thing, I agree. But then if there's like a strong HP pattern, like why, what could it, else could it be basically? And then, so it's kind of like, you know, I think the main problem is that like it's putting less emphasis on us as pathologists and more emphasis on like the interdisciplinary conference. And so it's like, you know, instead of taking our word for like things that we've seen patterns for like, you know, several decades now, basically, it's like, oh, now we're going to be focusing on a different aspect. So I understand like, you know, these other individuals' perspective, but I also like, you know, in our institute, I don't think we'll be moving to calling anything BIP anytime soon or ever, basically. So.
That's good. That's good to hear. Anybody else has moved on to abandoning HP as kind of a diagnostic line, or at least in the comment, and is full on with the BIP?
Hi, it's Margaret. Oh, go ahead, Henry. Ahead. No, you go ahead. Yeah. I'd rather hear you first. I want to know what you say.
We've gone to somewhere in the middle. And I think we just had a discussion at a meeting this weekend, and you know, if sometimes you get the history right. There's a bird, there's mold, and in those cases, I'll say hypersensitivity pneumonitis with a prominent, you know, BIP pattern, or if it's like this really should be HP. I mean, and I think the guidelines say, you know, you can say BIP, most suggestive of hypersensitivity pneumonitis, and I,
right,
you know. I think there's probably ways to incorporate both of these. And, you know, guidelines are just guidelines. And so in any individual patient, I may or may not use them. Same thing with, I almost never put probable UIP on the bottom line. I mean, that's not a diagnosis that I, you know, would really use. And I think,
yeah.
I think most of our group does that. I think Yasmin has also, I think she jumped in first, if I'm not mistaken, but it just depends on what cases you have coming across your desk, right? And, so we're somewhere in the middle, I guess.
Yeah, that's very similar to what I was thinking. I haven't had a case yet, but since this came out, but I don't see the problem with saying this is a certain pattern which fits very well with HP, could be compatible with, depending on blah, blah, blah. But and I think most clinicians do know that if there isn't an inciting antigen found, that they can still treat them as HP. I think the problem might be the clinicians might be getting very confused. So I think pathologists' reports need to explain that, yeah, this is compatible with HP. Like Henry, I never say this is HP. I never say this is IPF, right? So I think it might be an area that the clinicians will get very confused very fast in. But I can see the middle ground here. And I think, yeah, some of these very bronchiocentric patterns, years later, they have turned out to be CTD. And I think there are some things we still don't know about CTD. And some of these bronchiocentric patterns are very, very strange.
Indeed. Well, I guess we'll just have to leave it at that. Great discussion. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate everybody bearing with the technical difficulties. And thanks, Heather, for helping me along with that as well. I hope everyone has a great day.
All right.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.